Cephalopod. It's star date May the something. I'm Chris Hewitt, and this is the first Empire Podcast Star Trek Into Darkness spoiler special. The first, I hear you say. Well, yes, this one, and forewarned is forearmed, will consist of Team Empire. That's me, Ali Plum.
Hello.
And our resident Trekkeries, which is a combination of Trekker and Trekkie, so no one will get offended. Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
And James Dyer.
Kaplach.
What the hell was that?
That would be Klingon.
Klingon. Okay, excellent. We're going to be blathering on about J.J. Abrams' sequel, Star Trek Into Darkness. It's just going to be us. But a second spoiler podcast will feature hugely spoilerific interviews with the film's producers and writers, Damon Lindelof, Bob Orsi, Alex Kurtzman, and producer Brian Burke. That's going to be up on the 24th of May.
Why the delay, Chris?
Well, that's going to give everyone, especially in the States where it opens a week later, a chance to watch the film and absorb its many shocks, twists, and turns. Although, if you want to absorb one of its many shocks, twists, and turns, go to the IMDb now, where one of those many shocks, twists, and turns is there for all to see.
Is he credited?
Yes, it's a spoiler podcast. So anyway, go away if you haven't seen Star Trek Into Darkness, because we're going to be venturing into the spoiler territory. Yes, he's credited after all those months of subterfuge
as John
and cloaking devices. Benedict Cumberbatch is listed on the IMDb page for this movie.
As
Khan.
As George Ringo.
Which is really the Qui-Gon's noble end of this franchise. Yeah. If you don't know what that's a reference to, it's the...
John Williams film. Soundtrack.
I've just spoiled the Phantom Menace. Yeah. There was so much subterfuge around that movie as well. And then it was 2 months before it came out, the soundtrack came out with Qui-Gon's noble
track
end.
Track 13 or something is Qui-Gon's
death
noble
death
end.
Qui-Gon's,
Qui-Gon's noble end.
No, it is.
Qui-Gon's noble end. Qui-Gon's funeral is the next track as well. And then there were
just in case you hadn't Qui-Gon's died.
Yeah. 17. Seriously, guys, Qui-Gon's dead.
He's Qui-Gon.
He's Qui-Gon.
He was Qui-Gon.
He's a Qui-Goner. Okay, so we're going to start, I guess, with the big revelation. I've got a list here. Helen, I know you've got your big geeky list of Star Trek stuff. You two guys are the Star Trekkers.
Ali,
where would you put yourself on the Star Trek scale?
I used to make sure I got home on time so I could watch John Luke, but that's basically it.
Get out.
There's nothing else that I really care about.
Yeah, same here. I was kind of a next gen, and I like the movies. But original series, a little bit of exposure to that. A little bit of exposure to Deep Space Nine. Nothing to Voyager and Enterprise, and I believe I've missed a dodged bullet here. It was a load of rubbish.
You may have dodged a bullet.
There were moments, but let's face it, it wasn't.
When the Zindi got involved, it became more interesting.
Oh God!
Oh God! Okay, Chris, come on. It's a Star Trek.
I may check out of the
Star Trek special. you have to kind of keep in the headset.
That's true. If you're with us, congratulations. Still, so Khan, yes. So the big bad guy of this movie is not John Harrison or Ringo Lennon or whatever they were going to call him. It is, in fact, Khan. And it's revealed roughly halfway through the movie. It's the worst kept secret of the summer. But what did we feel when it was finally revealed to be Khan?
Well, I mean, Benedict Cumberbatch makes for a very sinister villain. And a surprisingly kind of muscular villain. I mean, I don't think any of us had many doubts that he'd be able to handle the, you know, incredible intellect side of things. But the beating numerous people up, including an entire squadron of Klingons.
Yeah.
That was more impressive. So,
stretched it just a little bit.
Oh, come now.
Saying.
He's a Superman.
He is.
I guess, but he beats people up in Sherlock all the time.
Well, a little bit less. It's not quite on the same scale.
It's not quite genetically engineered.
I mean, he occasionally punches one guy in Sherlock. You know.
What do we think about the choice of Khan as a villain for this movie? As we'll see in the spoiler podcast with the writers and producers in a couple of weeks' time, they felt it was almost inevitable that they would go down this route. Do you feel that? Because Khan, I think for many people, is maybe the Star Trek bad guy. James, you'll probably disagree with me. The Borg Klingons, blah blah blah. But I think most people will think Wrath of Khan is the best Star Trek film.
Yes.
And so maybe doing this was a bit obvious.
I thought it was something of the opposite. I would have veered away from this personally as a choice. Khan from the original series is I wouldn't say he's throwaway, but it's one episode.
Yeah.
He's only made famous by The Wrath of Khan, which, as you say, is the best film, which is why everyone remembers it. But that aside, you don't think Star Trek, you don't think Khan. I mean, I probably would have played up the Klingon angle myself. Were I doing it? I know JJ likes the Klingons. I'm surprised. Which should be why they're in there. But I would have maybe spent more time on that before sending the Enterprise off on a 5-year mission to the far corners of the galaxy.
In the first movie, Eric Banner's bad guy felt more to me Khan-y in terms of vengeance and a Kirk and, you know, a kind of a vendetta thing. and obviously had the bug, which was obviously a Khan hat tip in its own way. But with this, I didn't feel like there was a real I hate Kirk thing.
No.
I wanted from Khan a real, you know, heads butting type deal. But because of the way they concentrated it more on Spock versus Kirk friendship thing, I didn't get that.
Well, I think the reason that they really couldn't do that is because essentially this isn't replacing the Wrath of Khan, or it shouldn't be in the timeline, if you like. This should be replacing Space Seed, which is the episode where he originally appeared. So they don't have that history. Mm. And I think that's part of what made Wrath of Khan so good. Even if you'd never seen that episode, and I hadn't when I first saw Wrath of Khan,
you still get
that, don't you? You still get the idea this guy has a grudge against Kirk. That's why everything that follows happens. And I think because you didn't have that past connection here, you did lose something of the menace that you had in Wrath of Khan. And yeah, you're quite right. I mean, you're actually, weirdly, you had that in the first film and not this one.
So I was saying, it's an oddly weird setup. I mean, the Wrath of Khan is in the title. The whole thing is predicated on revenge. I mean, it's a loose retelling of Moby Dick. The whole thing is Khan's obsession with getting revenge on Kirk is his undoing. That's the whole point of it. And what gives it relevance is that you've earned that. You've earned that because in Space Seed, he's left marooned on set the Alpha 5. And he stays there, and he's been there for years, and it all goes horribly wrong. And then he comes back, and he's a mite peeved. Whereas in this, you sort of see Khan in his sort of raw, uncooked state. You know, this is his first encounter with them. And it's great, and it is a different story. And I like the way it plays out. You know, I very much enjoyed it for what it was. But it seemed an odd thing to do. Mm. It really did seem an odd thing to reference, especially if from a Star Trek point of view, you are conceding that Star Trek 2 is the best. Do you really want to be drawing parallels to a great film, like arguably the best Star Trek film?
That's, I think, it's a sure confidence.
Into the wind
it's a
bit.
Sign of confidence from JJ and his team. I was intrigued by a lot of the aspects of that. I think the direct parallels with Wrath of Khan, we'll get onto those in a few minutes, I guess. I wasn't too enamored with that. But the Khan Kirk relationship, I quite enjoyed. I quite enjoyed the little wrinkles, that the fact they had to team up, the fact that they didn't put Khan against Kirk at any point because, frankly, he would have killed him within 5 seconds flat. Mm. And it's interesting, you're talking about the Khan-Kirk vendetta that drives Wrath of Khan. And if you were to do, say, for example, because they have Cumberbatch on ice, not literally, but in the movie they do, and just to, you know, defrost in case of emergency. So if they do Star Trek 3, or sorry, 13.
Whichever.
Yeah, I know. I got hammered on Twitter the other day when I called it Star Trek 2, knowing that most people would call it Star Trek 2, and I know the Star Trek 2 is Wrath of Khan. I know this is Star Trek 12.
It's okay, but, Chris. Yeah, just let out
I was
pain.
Attacked by those evil Star Trek villains, the pedants. They were very, very annoying. So yes, if they do Star Trek 13 or 14, 15 and bring Cumberbatch back in, say, 10 years' time and do that storyline, they can't really do it with Kirk, because Kirk doesn't really do anything to Khan in this movie. It's Spock who does the who upsets Khan. It's Spock who fires on his ship ultimately, and it's Spock who he fights against at the end of the movie. Whereas Kirk is kind of cooling off somewhere.
I'm gonna put on my Star Trek nerd ears.
Please, by all means. Stage. I'm surprised you've taken them off, frankly.
This is the one part, and we talked about the physicality of Khan a little bit early on. This is the one part I thought, if anything, that JJ ever so slightly fumbled, which is the climatic fight where Spock faces off against Khan. Mm. The point of that, the relevance of that, is exactly as you said, that Kirk could never stand up to Khan. He's genetically modified. He would kick his ass. The point is that Spock, being Vulcan, is many, many times stronger than a human. Mm-hmm. So the point is only he could go hand to hand with Khan in this. But you don't really get that. And in fact, if you don't know Star Trek, you wouldn't even know that Spock as a Vulcan is stronger than a human.
It needed maybe just that one little bit.
You
of
needed like a line, and there needs to be a moment where you see, you know, Khan should turn around and think, okay, now this is going to be a fight. And I think you got a fight out of them. That was fine. And the bit where he's resisting the nerve pinch and all, that's quite fun. But I think for non-Star Trek fans, that's it probably felt a bit odd.
Yeah.
When Khan gets stunned on the big dreadnought ship.
A little inconsistency there.
He goes down.
He does.
When he's on the floating red ship, which means nothing to me, and I don't understand why it's
going to
the
city. He takes 5 to the chest.
He takes 6, and it looks great, because he's like,
I guess that the implication is not that he woke up quickly from the stun gun first time, but that he was faking all along the first time. For what reasons, I'm not quite sure. But I guess that must be what you take away from that. That's the only way it would make sense.
One of my sort of favourite parts of the film, that particular bit, is just when he gets up and just the offhanded way that he just snaps Alice Eve's leg, just stamps on it.
Yeah.
And obviously it happens out of frame, but it's really brutal. And then obviously goes up to Mr. Weller and crushes his skull, which again, you don't see, but it's very, very nasty. Mm. I think that's the Into Darkness moment for me. The fact that Alice Eve gets over having a leg snap very, very quickly is neither here nor there.
Well, it is a 23rd century.
It is, but she screams. And then after that, she just sobs a little bit gently and has a bit of a bruise.
That's why they call him Bones, presumably, because he can set bones really. He cures death later on.
But that's the point. And that's an interesting part, because the Khan morality element sort of vacillates backwards and forth. So you have Khan, the villain, he's the terrorist. Yep. And then you have Khan, the fluffy Khan. But he's only fluffy because they make Peter Weller very, very evil to kind of to make you more sympathetic towards Khan. And then when it swings back again to sort of underline the evilness of Khan, he snaps a woman's leg offhandedly.
Yeah.
And those are maybe not the subtlest beats, but they do the job.
Well, my feeling with the movie was that Khan wasn't really the bad guy, as we'll discuss. Yeah. Admiral Marcus was the bad guy in this movie, which is another nice, interesting little twist that I didn't really see coming. If I didn't see coming at all,
that was the twist. Nobody, I think, saw coming.
I think people may guess very early on. There's a fair amount of foreshadowing about the warp engine. It may leak, and if that happens, someone's going to have to go in there and sacrifice themselves. Of course, in Wrath of Khan, going back to Spock's physiology, he goes in and absorbs radiation leak because he can. As a Vulcan, he can absorb many more.
Well, it does kill
radiation.
Him.
But my point is that Kirk survives it for quite a long time.
Yes. It's more logical, certainly.
Yeah, it is more logical, as you rightly say. My feeling about the Khan thing is that it was kind of fuzzy what he wanted as a bad guy. There was a vague line at one point about, he doesn't like anyone who's inferior to him, and he thinks everyone's inferior to him, so if he gets away from us, he'll go on a killing spree, and that's pretty bad. But otherwise, I thought he was quite a charismatic bad guy. I almost suffered from Hans Gruber syndrome in a way, in that he was as charismatic, if not more charismatic, than the heroes.
Far more so than Kirk. This is interesting, because Kirk, in the first film, I think carries the film on his charisma. That moment in the Kobayashi Maru, where he bites into the apple, I think is one of the best Kirk moments in the first film. It's fantastic. And there's nothing quite so cocksure or appealing in this one. And I think part of that, it's not Chris Pine's fault, it's that Cumberbatch so overshadows him that by the second half of the film, you can't help but be just so enamoured with Khan that you're less worried about what happens to Kirk on Fuck Kirk. It's more Khan. We can't have bad things happen to Khan. Khan must not die. So that's the thing. I loved Khan.
Yeah, but you always
manly. It's sort of very heterosexual.
You always
manly
have
love.
Sympathy for the evildoer. It's in your nature.
Yeah, that may speak to me.
I found Kirk quite charming. I found him quite funny. I liked the sex scene with the two cat girls. I liked the little funny banter between him and Bones and Spock, and I thought it was funny. This film made me chuckle, and he was a big part of it.
In a different way, though, the humour's slightly more mature in the first one. Like, there's no swollen hands or slapstick humour.
No.
I didn't think the humour was quite as prevalent in this one. But no, you're right. Yeah.
I thought it was pretty funny. It wasn't Iron Man 3 in a way. It didn't have me chuckling every 5 minutes. Mm. But I don't get your thing about Chris Pine. I think he's very charismatic. I think he's great as Kirk. I liked him a lot in this movie.
Well, fine.
I have a certain amount of sympathy. I think he's a little bit underserved. And the fact that he's removed for the last act, essentially. And I get why we've discussed that. But at the same time, it's a bit of an odd choice to sideline your hero, essentially. Yeah. I also felt like the Bones relationship was a little underserved, because that was... I mean, yes, Kirk and Spock are the firmest links of that triumvirate, if you will, but it is a triumvirate with Bones.
Absolutely.
And you didn't get to see much of the three of them together. Having said that, there were great moments for Scotty, you know, there were great moments for Uhura, so they were clearly trying to give everybody something to do.
Well, if you watch Wrath of Khan again, and I did the other day,
because
my wife hadn't seen it, and she's a big, big fan of the Abrams Star Trek movies, it's very, very interesting. Obviously, growing up in the films and a little bit of the original series, as I said, but for me, of this iteration of Star Trek, it is Spock, Kirk and McCoy. That's the holy trinity for me. And it was interesting, even on our cover recently, our big gatefold cover that Carl Urban, who I think is fantastic as Bones, was on the second portion of the cover, and it was Uhura on the front cover. So I think this series, this iteration of Star Trek, is very much underserving Bones slightly. If you look at Wrath of Khan, it does say starring William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, DeForest Kelly, and then it's also starring everyone else. So even that movie thinks it's very much a triumvirate. But going back to Wrath of Khan is very, very interesting, because I think this whole idea about everyone on the crew needs to be served is a very, very new phenomenon. If you look back at Wrath of Khan, Uhura does nothing. She literally sits in her chair for the entire film and goes, "I'm patching someone through now, Captain." That's all she gets to do. I quite like the fact that they go out of their way now to make the crew feel more involved, and they give Sulu a moment, and they give Chekhov. Well, Chekhov's in the film.
Chekhov is there. God bless him. In fairness, they said themselves that's the person that they underserved. And
he does get to save. He does save Kirk.
Yeah.
Which is ultimately a futile gesture.
And he pushes the button. He pushes the button.
Yes, and he pronounces his W's in an interesting way.
He does. Yes.
Victor.
Which apparently more a Polish thing than a Russian. There you go.
Can we jump back to Khan's introduction?
True.
Because.
Okay.
His introduction or his introduction?
His introduction.
His Khan introduction. Is Khan.
You mean that introduction or the introduction in London where the camera goes up in his face and Michael Giacchino goes, da, da, da!
No, I'm talking about the chair spinning, cat petting type introduction he does inside the plastic glass cage of emotion.
Oh, right, okay.
If I were to say one thing about this film that annoyed me, it is the way Benedict Cumberbatch chewed the scenery there quite vigorously. I felt that he was a petit peu hammy when he was doing his Khan speech.
Mon Dieu.
Cumberbatch.
I don't want to ruffle any Cumberbatch feathers here. I can't believe I just said that, but...
Do they have feathers?
I'm going to stop now. Abort.
It's only a matter of time.
You know what? I'm very much... I loved that scene. I think he played it very well. I only wish there'd been more of it. I think the one thing that was missing for me, and I've said this in the office before, is that I think that we wanted a meaty dialogue mind-off scene between Khan and Kirk.
Yeah.
And that would have been, through the glass shield, that would have been the time for them to really back and forth. You know, give it 5 minutes, have a long chat. And I felt a little underserved in that regard. I thought we could have had a meeting of minds, a melding of minds,
I wanted more quotation of, you know, Shakespeare and Moby Dick. And
Moby Dick, yes.
From Hell's Heart, I stab it.
Perdition's flame!
Yes. That kind of stuff.
Cumberbatch is amazing. He's no Ricardo Montalban.
Well, that is true. And you may take that how you will.
I was expecting a few more pecs. Didn't see any upper torso from Benedict at all.
Not enough.
Yeah,
what a shame.
He's been talking, Cumberbatch, as well, about his incredible diet and workout regime for the movie, which left him very, very ripped, and he was eating nothing but chicken for months to get ready for the role. And you don't get to see his man nipples, which was...
I think
I can speak for everyone here at the table. We very, very disappointing indeed.
Right. Okay.
Uhura! Sorry, I just had to say that to get back on.
There you go.
Uhura!
Uhura. Like, Uhura.
Sure,
Uhura.
He's Northern Irish.
It's true, you are Northern Irish.
Uhura!
Uhura!
There was that incredibly gratuitous shot after she got out of the shuttlecraft on Kronos, and it's basically just, you know, and just in the foreground, her bottom, and then in the background, some Klingons.
Looked brilliant in IMAX.
I didn't notice that.
That's actually a fantastic shot, and I don't specifically mean the Uhura bottom. Specifically, it's that shot of the shuttle coming down and the camera moving in and coming in on the doorway. It's a lovely
well,
shot.
Speaking of gratuitous, I think Alice Eve going, "Oh, don't look around, don't look around." Boobs.
Yes.
It was. You know, when you see it, you go, "That was for the trailer." You know it was for the trailer.
It was for the trailer. It was absolutely for the trailer. That was. There was no real need for her to sort of strip off in that.
Also, Kirk is a bit pervy.
He's a little bit pervy,
isn't he?
Yeah.
He's a bit pervy generally. That's part of Kirk.
Surely, isn't that against the very tenets of Starfleet?
What, stripping off in a shuttlecraft?
No, like peeking on a co-worker stripping. I mean, James, you've frowned upon it every time I've tried to do it.
Yes.
And it
Starfleet HR is probably filling out reams of paperwork.
It strikes me that Kirk might get his wrist slapped.
He might.
I wouldn't worry about that too much. Can we talk about the blood? The magic blood?
Yes.
The magic blood.
Here is my thing. As soon as Kirk went into the room... which I have a whole heap of problems with anyway. But as soon as he went into the room, I leaned over to my brother, who was with me at the screening, and I said, "Khan's blood." Because I never had any doubt. And we hadn't even seen the Tribble move at that point, but I never had any doubt that it was going to bring him back to life, because it just seemed obvious. And here's my second problem with Khan's blood. If you have a guy whose blood cures death, why do you freeze him and not try to, I don't know, keep him around so you can keep taking his blood, synthesize it, and cure death?
There's also the fact that they didn't need Khan's blood at all because they had 72 yeah. other people with magic blood sitting in their cargo bay.
I can get maybe thought they didn't know that for sure that they had magic blood. Maybe they thought they didn't have time to find out. But
I'm just going
to
put in a caveat here for our readers. This is one of those things where we loved this film. We all loved this film. And it's going to sound like we're criticising it, yes. which is, of course, not what we're doing. But it's a great Star Trek tradition. I think you have to pick the holes and stuff, and you have to criticise the elements of it. That does not in any way take away from our enjoyment of it as a whole. There you go, caveat ends.
But you're right that that's a Star Trek thing. Like, even with individual episodes, I'd go, oh, that was great, but let's talk about how they teleported to there when they could easily have teleported to there.
Or in Next Generation, where they used the deflector dish in an entirely new way to fix everything.
Yeah, it's better than in Voyager when they use bioneural gel packs for things.
Ali, I'm scared now. What's happening?
I've got my toe in the water. I'm worried I might be pulled in.
Yes, sharks are circling.
But you know those terrible things they do online? I absolutely hate these videos. You can't help but watch them sometimes.
Oh, yeah, everything that's wrong with
the
nonsense.
Movie Sin Tally, yeah. which looks like it was created by the snarkiest, angriest, I've never enjoyed anything in my life. If you bought me a cake, I'd
dreadful.
Punch you for it.
Dreadful. And yet I watched
videos.
Them all.
And you watched
yeah,
them.
I watched them all.
And if you watch the original Star Trek movie Sin Tally, they are making the most pathetic things. You know when he drives up on his motorbike to the where the ships, Enterprise is being yep. assembled, and they go, there's no way NASA would let you get that close to where they're assembling their newest ship. And you just want to go, it's a movie! So with that in mind,
also
we are
technically
taking...
the starships are assembled at the Utopia Planitia shipyards, which are in orbit,
yeah,
not
they should
on
have been
planet.
In orbit. That was the,
just
that
saying.
Was the problem.
You can't
there.
Assemble a starship in gravity. It has to be done in space.
That makes no sense.
To quote Star Trek, Ali, we've taken our first steps into a larger world.
And while we're there, I'm gonna roll out this another issue I have, which is a basic misunderstanding of the concept of trans war. This is what I'm going to get in there.
This is true.
We're going to say the things we liked about this movie in a second.
We are, yes. But what I'm saying is, we're going to absolutely go proper nerd fi on this. Okay. What Scotty discovers in the first Star Trek is not actually transwarp, it's being able to transport at warp, which is not the same thing. And that is what we are led to believe is what Khan has essentially stolen, because he says that Scotty's research has been stolen. But what he does is he transports halfway across the Alpha Quadrant to Kronos, the Klingon homeworld, yeah. which is a technology owned by no one except, to the best of my knowledge, the Borg, which is transwarp travel, which is something that the Federation never ever develops at any point during any of the series.
Explain for me what transwarp travel is.
It's essentially
instantaneous travel across the universe.
Yeah, basically.
So it's faster than warp speed.
Hardcore. It's not even that. It's hardcore transporting. So, boom. That's it. That's my explanation. Vroom.
But if you have that, then that really scuppers the next movie, because this is technology that exists, then surely the whole trekking is a bit...
I don't think it does. I think they got a little bit confused.
Okay. It's like in Superman, where he turned the world backwards.
You can really do that.
So he definitely,
he definitely
teleports...
To Kronos. From his shuttlecraft.
He doesn't
yes.
teleport to a ship.
No.
But the thing is, that would have been the easiest thing. He transports to a ship in orbit and then flies to Kronos. That would have been absolutely spot on, probably what he should have done. But, and also, this is the thing, Kronos is not next to Earth. It's so phenomenally far away, it's not even funny.
And is it still far away in this Star Trek universe?
I mean,
the geography of the universe isn't different. They've taken pains to sort of say this, that the timeline is different, but the fundamentals of the universe remain the same. Kronos, obviously, is the Klingon homeworld, which yes. is at the heart of the Klingon Empire. Uh-huh. So one might argue that it would be very difficult to fly the Federation flagship and park in orbit. But, you know,
we are just saying. Edging into some very dark territory.
It's pedantry.
I can't help but comment, if that's the case, then why is the neutral zone so close to the homeworld of the Klingon Empire that they have to park outside of it?
And space is a big place. I mean,
it's the final frontier.
It's huge. I mean,
it is huge.
The Enterprise isn't that big. You could probably park for a little bit.
Before the Klingon traffic wardens come by and say,
"Yeah, all right, mate, move it on.
You're in a
move it
zone.
On." Yeah,
you know that walk to your local news agents.
Yeah,
it's peanuts to space.
He's not wrong.
That is true.
Incidentally, while we're on yes. pedantry in the Klingon homeworld, you will have seen there's a moon next to the Klingon homeworld, which is
I know this.
That's no moon.
I know this.
Come on, Chris.
Mooney. No, wait. It is Praxis.
There we go.
No,
Praxis?
It may or may not be Praxis. The point is, in Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, Praxis, which is a moon orbiting Kronos, explodes and causes problems for the Klingons. So there was a moon here that looked semi-exploded, sort of, you know, it was
bits of it hanging off.
I don't know quite what was going on there.
Coming into the planet.
I wasn't sure if this was a reference to Praxis or
it's an interesting thing. I actually asked Orsi and Kurtzman about this, and I think they misunderstood my question because they forgot about that shot, which clearly shows a moon kind of colliding with the planet, and just addressed the environmental concerns. They said there'd been something gone wrong, but they didn't.
So maybe they've accelerated the Praxis thing.
Maybe. Which seems an odd thing to change as a result of everything that was changed last time.
I think it was a nice, pretty bit of art direction. Yeah, I don't think there was much more to it than that, because the point is that it endangers the life of the whole Empire in Star Trek 6.
I wonder if they were pissed off upon seeing Oblivion, in which the same image pretty much appears.
It may in fact be that.
Yeah, that might have been that. Talking about some of the crew in the movie, I mean, we haven't really touched upon Zachary Quinto's Spock yet, but one standout for me, and I think J.J. Abrams loves this guy, is Simon Pegg, who you think doesn't get a lot to do initially. He disappears quite early on. He quits in a fit of pique over the torpedoes
not so much a fit of pique as a justifiable concern.
Yeah, he's proved right in the end.
Yeah. But then gets his own little strand, and I think for me gets the film's funniest joke as well, the Run Scotty Run element, where he runs down that massive corridor, which I believe, Helen, you prized out from Simon that they made him do for real.
They did, and he basically threw up. As he'd been running so hard, he went for it. So well done, Mr. Pegg, your training has paid off. But yeah, he'd unwisely perhaps eaten some antipasti right before, and that wasn't necessarily the best.
Scotty
time.
Definitely has the funniest show. I'm not sure it was that. I like the old shh.
Yeah, that's funny.
Obviously, this letter part of that word is taken up with the classic Star Trek door opening sound.
Yeah, which is a nice little reference. Have you seen Airplane 2, the sequel?
Yes.
Where Shatner turns up at the end and they open the doors by going shh, shh, and the doors go back to them. It's very, very funny.
There's also another nice reference in there to, I believe it's Section 31, which is what Khan blows up, which is the library, which turns out is the headquarters of Section 31, which is William Sadler's outfit in Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Really?
So it's essentially there. It's the MI6 of the Federation, and it's run by William Sadler.
I have to say, this is one of my slight concerns with the film, and it's good to hear that, because pretty much people have been talking about this is a film with loads of geeky references, this is loads of stuff for nerds, for fans, whatever, whatever. And the fact is, in a lot of ways, it kind of isn't. What this film references is Wrath of Khan and the 2009 Star Trek. There are calls back to the 2009 Star Trek, you know, the space jump, even playing the Beastie Boys early on. And there are obviously huge nods to Wrath of Khan, but there's very little to the rest of the Star Trek canon. So I actually don't think this is a film for nerds. I think this is a film for casual viewers.
Yeah, I don't get that. I mean, obviously the Wrath of Khan stuff at the end.
Sure.
People will get, fans will get, but yeah, I didn't think it was too
dynamic. This comes back to Abrams, though, isn't it, that he's not a Star Trek fan. He's aware of the Star Trek universe. He's not inside, you know what I mean? He's on the outside looking in still.
But then I think what they did quite well last time was that they put in those references anyway, and it didn't matter if you didn't get them, because they still worked for the story. You know, things like the little worm, things like the Tribble in the cage in Scotty's place. You know, there were lots of those little touches that you didn't have to get, but if you got them, that was a bonus. And that was really lacking this time, actually. It wasn't... I don't think it's a film that's particularly geared towards Star Trek fans, and I think that those reviews that have said, oh, this is so nerdy, are showing how little they know.
I don't get that. Where do we think this leaves the Star Trek universe? Because JJ is obviously going off now to do another Star movie. It looks like he may not be back. I can't see him coming back.
It felt from the end of this movie like he wasn't.
It was a sign-off, wasn't it?
Yeah, it felt like he was wrapping things up. I mean, perhaps wrapping things up for the next guy.
Yeah, but certainly I don't think they're going to stop. Unless, of course, it doesn't do particularly well, but I can't see that happening.
I was very frustrated by that ending because it was too similar to the first one, but also we are on the precipice at the end of that film, even if it is a year after the events of whatever you want to call this. The Klingons ain't pleased with the Federation, and this has been built up, and a big, you know, turn in this movie has been about the Klingons. We get to see them, and then they're off into deep, we haven't explored this country, undiscovered country.
The one thing I will say about that, they do go off on a mission. You think, well, they're leaving everything behind. They're heading off into outer space. There's an element of that. I mean, if you consult your star map, you will see that, obviously, they're exploring the space is limited to their quadrant of space, which is like the Alpha Quadrant, and the Klingon Empire is a part of that. So they're never actually going to be all that far from Klingon space.
Yeah, there's always a Klingon.
There's always a Klingon.
there's always a Romulan.
There's no saying that they weren't necessarily encountered to the Klingons while on their 5-year mission. So,
But it seems to me this movie sets up two kind of space seeds, if you will, for the next installment. Thank you. Klingons, definitely. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, James and Helen, but we've never really seen a major, large-scale Federation Klingon conflict, have
no,
we?
No, because the point of the Federation has always been to try and avoid all-out war. So we've seen them multiple times avoid war.
Brinkmanship is what they specialise in.
Indeed. Yeah.
Which is one of the interesting themes of this movie about the militarisation of Starfleet. And what Admiral Marcus is doing. He is preparing for war. He thinks war is inevitable. And it's interesting, given if you follow Roberto Orsi on Twitter, at Bob Orsi, I think is his Twitter handle, he's quite the conspiracy theorist, and he's very much about mistrusting the government, which is very, very much one of the themes here. You don't always believe what your government tells you, and dig a little deeper, which is a very interesting statement for a big summer movie to be making.
Ellen's absolutely right, though. The Federation's never been about militarising space, because Gene Roddenberry had very, very fixed ideals of what he wanted the future to be, this sort of dream ideal, egalitarian cooperation and exploration, pacifism. What's interesting is that when Star Trek got really interesting in Deep Space Nine was specifically because they started to militarise they were under threat from the Dominion. And because that was so against what Star Trek had always been up to, it was suddenly really interesting, and exactly this sort of thing had been happening.
Did that piss off the fans?
People loved it. I mean, you had William Shatner doing all of this Section 31 stuff. You had the Federation that built the Defiant, the ship in collaboration with the Romulan Star Empire. And it was the first Federation warship. But it was much, much smaller than the Dreadnought in this.
Is it called the Dreadnought in the movie? Or what's it called?
Yeah. It's a Dreadnought class.
Dreadnought class.
It's a Dreadnought class. Okay, but it's not called the USS.
And in case we were under any illusions that it might be a good ship, it's dark and spiky and evil looking. The fight they have, the little sort of like when they come out of war, the fight between the Enterprise and the Dreadnought is nice. Star Trek is famous for really tedious space fights because the ships sit next to each other, they don't move, and they exchange beams of light which impact each other's shields while everyone inside falls about.
So you sunk my battleship.
Indeed. F3. Whereas one of the things I like most about Wrath of Khan is when the Reliant and the Enterprise face off, they essentially do what it's old school sort of
naval battles.
It's naval battle, they do passes while strafing each other's hulls. It's really nicely done.
I think that's mostly a limitation of the special effects back in the day, because what they do with for the series is up to the Next Generation, at least, possibly beyond, was they had models
and they had to
do about five passes to get all the lights. So you had to do a pass for the body of the ship, a pass for the lights on the ship, a pass for the stars, pass for the deflector, and get the camera movements exactly right each time, and blah blah blah. Anyway, nerdy.
I really like that mid-warp fight.
That was really cool. The other bits where I was in my seat
going, I'm so glad I'm watching this at cinema. This is such a treat.
And watching the Enterprise being absolutely owned by Robocop was the beginning
when you see the Star Trek Into Darkness title come up, but then it's just like the music comes up, which you haven't heard properly yet in full. That comes up, and then the warp trails just go.
Giacchino's score is fantastic. I really like that.
I think he's
Goosebumps.
I'm sure we've said this in the podcast before, but he, for me, is the heir to John Williams.
Yeah.
Isn't he?
He's fantastic.
He's the only guy out there. I mean, really interestingly, Brian Tyler stepped to the fore, I think, this summer with his Iron Man 3 score, which is really, really good, and has, as I'm sure we've banged on about on the podcast, Can You Dig It, which is the song of the year for me.
So good.
But Giacchino is the only one, for me, of the kind of new breed of composers who seems to deal almost entirely in melody. And theme and motifs, and actually wants to take on that Williams gauntlet. You know, you get very people like Hans Zimmer at the moment who seem to be dealing in very atonal sounds, and they seem to be shying
very
away from melody.
Back, yeah.
And it's interesting. The Star Trek theme is the new one, the Giacchino one, is incredibly hummable and very memorable. Which is such an interesting thing, given that he's going up against two of the great theme tunes of all time, if you include the Jerry Goldsmith Next Generation theme. And I'm sure, James, you've got a soft spot for Deep Space Nine's Warblings.
Yes. I don't like the Enterprise theme. Yes, that was it.
Okay, what was the Enterprise theme?
That was seasons three, seasons four and onwards, when the Deep Space Nine theme tune goes a little bit up-tempo and has a drum beat underneath it.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
When you say cool.
But Giacchino, interestingly, JJ said probably won't be doing the Star Wars thing for him.
Well, Giacchino's always said John Williams.
Because it's John Williams' back, isn't it? Yeah. You can't take it away.
Well, you might as well.
That would be wrong.
He's got track record, the guy, but it's going to be interesting. Anyway, what were we talking about? We're talking about what you could do with Star Trek 3. 13 is obviously you're setting up Klingons. Mm. I'd love to see that. I'd love to see a massive... I know you're saying that the Federation wouldn't necessarily do it, but if you're attacked by the Klingons, surely they'd fight back.
Well, right? Oh, no, they absolutely... Yeah, they would do. And there's lots of... the most famous Star Trek episodes, you know, Best of Both Worlds, it's the Federation getting its ass kicked by a military foe.
Yeah. It's
always most interesting. The space battles have always been a high point.
The other thing is, of course, what's changed in this timeline is you don't have Vulcan. And Vulcan, while, you know, pacifistic in itself, is also a hub of technology and a hub of space power.
The Minbari of the Star Trek universe, if you like.
If you will, indeed. So the fact that that's now been taken out and that the Vulcan population is much smaller does mean that you have, you know, you have a big gap in the Federation's defences, not to mention the fact that the Federation also got their asses kicked in 2009
and lost a lot of ships. And apparently have built no new ones,
which is bizarre. There's still a reference in this film to, the Enterprise is the newest ship in the fleet. So apparently in the past year, all they've done is build this super secret ship.
Well, he's been diverting all his funds and they've got to rebuild the place in London.
You would think somebody would have asked them.
I would hesitate to say that they might take a while to build. They're quite
I'm sure they do. Ships over the back of the moon.
But what I'm saying is, you have a big gap in the Federation's defences. That does leave them more vulnerable. That means they're probably going to be, as we saw with Weller's character, more scared, more paranoid, and that could lead to militarism. So there's a really interesting opportunity here to do something.
But there is probably a small fleet being assembled at the Foxconn factory in China. So at some point they'll roll those out.
Can we talk in more detail about the hand-to-hand, and by hand-to-hand I mean glass-to-hand,
the Rathacan stuff.
Yeah, because I personally found that the shout "Khan!" didn't work for me, but I actually quite enjoyed the bit before that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't think the friendship's been as deeply etched as, when you look at Rathacan, you're not just talking about, you know, guys they're, what, 30 years of friendship in the film?
It hasn't been earned at this
stage. It hasn't been earned, necessarily, and I felt as well that giving Spock that line smelled a little bit of fanboy service or fan person.
Not a very Spock-like thing to do.
Not a very Spock-like thing to do. If I recall correctly from the first Star Trek, or Star Trek 11, is when Vulcan dies, when his planet blows up, when his mother gets killed in front of his eyes, along with billions of his people, he kind of takes it on the chin.
He gets emotionally compromised,
but it's not like he goes around. I mean, he gets a little bit wibbly wobbly.
He wails on Kirk at one point. But yes, you're right. He doesn't go
Vulcan. No. It just seemed like okay, but then you could argue that there are maybe echoes of a timeline filtering through this universe, maybe in a sort of sliding doors.
That's what we talked to the writers about. I feel like I would have been happy if they had done that scene in another way. I have no problem thematically, story-wise, whatever, having Kirk sacrifice himself for the ship, because they talked about this all being about responsibility. And I think that comes across in the story, that it's Kirk growing up and taking charge, not just taking command, but also kind of taking responsibility for his ship. And so having him sacrifice himself for his people totally works for me on every character and story level that you can imagine. What I had a problem with was the direct rehash of Khan. And I felt like that was just a too close a nod, too on the nose, and didn't quite work.
Many people who watch this movie who won't have seen Wrath of Khan.
And so I guess it's true. Don't remember it well, but it's still not the best way you could have done it.
I guess so. My main problem with it is, and again, we have to stress, and we will talk about the things we loved about this movie in 2 seconds. Thing that slightly bothered me about that, the whole Kirk thing, was if you're going to kill him, and keep him dead until the next movie, and bring him back Spock-like somehow. You'll figure it out. You're a smart guy.
That might be a reference beat too far, though.
I don't know. It just seemed cheap to me.
You didn't believe it.
They killed him, and you thought, well, he's not dead.
It was like his demotion at the beginning of the film, which lasts 5 minutes. You know, you didn't feel the sense that there was any kind of consequence to it. Like, you didn't believe he'd be dead. You didn't for 1 second really worry about him. And I think the problem with that scene there is a little bit Bourne Legacy syndrome, which is that if there's a arguably a better film out there, do you want to keep drawing people's attention to it? That was just my thought.
There's no point in doing it if you can't do it really better.
Yes.
And frankly, what you should be doing is doing something different, I think.
Absolutely.
Because that scene in Rathacan is one of the greatest cinematic scenes. It really is phenomenal. It's incredibly well done. But it's the weight of just the consequence of it, the magnitude of it, to kill Spock. And the moment they share through the glass is just astonishing. It's poetic. It brings a tear to the eye.
The funeral.
Absolutely. Every part of that is magical. And then this, which is, and to be fair, this is not a bad scene. It's not badly done in any way, shape, or form. But sat side by side with that scene from Khan, it feels ham-fisted.
Yeah.
And I think that's the only...
Another interesting thing about the death of Spock in Wrath of Khan is they've defeated the bad guy by that point.
Yeah.
It is the final sacrifice. Yeah. So the movie builds up to that and ends in that moment, mm-hmm. whereas this is kind of a little bit lost in the mix. So one minute, you know, Spock is mourning the death of Kirk, and the next minute he's fighting a guy in a rubbish barge that's floating through Earth. It just seems... I would have liked to see... it ended with the death of Kirk. And yeah, you guys may not agree, but I would have liked to see him stay dead. Until
see, I'm glad they didn't end with the death of Kirk, simply because it enabled you to get past that and move onwards. Yeah, if that had been the final note, I'd have been quite down coming out of
well,
it.
What, for example, if you were watching Empire Strikes Back for the first time? They made it now, okay?
Yeah.
And you were watching Empire Strikes Back for the first time, and Luke gets his hand cut off, Han gets put into carbonite, and you go, oh my god, this is awful. And then 5 minutes later, Luke gets a new hand put back on, which of course, and Han magically comes back out of the carbonite, goes, hey guys, I'm alright now.
Yes.
Much worse movie.
Yes.
So I think I would love to have seen that cliffhanger for 3 years just going, or 3-4 years going, well, how are they going to do this? How are they going to reverse what they've done with Kirk?
I agree with what you're saying to an extent. The thing is about the carbonite thing is you know that it's not necessarily dead. And
no,
you also know that there is technology that can rebuild one.
But I imagine people came out of Empire Strikes Back in 1980 with their jaws on the floor. I can't.
It's a very brave way to end the film.
What the hell
Darth Vader
just
is
happened?
Luke's dad?
Yeah, whereas this, the stakes just kind of feel, you know, and you're dead. We can fix that.
The way I would have done it, and this is not, I hate to reference Crank again, I would do it with the bed, we'd have a bed scene, final credit sting right at the very end where you see Kirk, perhaps, you know, funeral style just there, and then Bones might be there and may have inserted something, and then you see a flicker of an eyelid, then a cut.
Mm-hmm. Mm. What's that noise? What's he done? Where's Ali gone? He's gone. He's literally... teleported.
He's been mysteriously beamed out, presumably to Kronos, the Klingon homeworld.
Yes, or an Arrested Development junket. One of the two. I can't quite put my finger on which it might possibly be. But okay, we're going to soldier on. Kirk, Spock and McCoy. I'm not going to say which one's which. Bagsy McCoy. Do I want to be McCoy? I don't know. Anyway.
Probably not.
Yeah. None of those are girls. I object. Yeah.
That's
anywho,
carry on. Yes.
I don't know. I was just going to say how well paced the film is. I mean, it really is kind of relentless. It does not stop the whole way through, do you know what I mean? Which I think is a good thing, because quite frankly, there have been a lot of films this summer and just in the last couple of years where
there's a lot of
films
that just stop.
Fat. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's no fat at all on this.
Mm, it is very lean, and it does move very, very quickly.
Mm. We've mentioned the Klingons a little bit. They're on the starboard bow of this film, and thank you.
Very good.
Thank you. I once got up when I was a small boy at primary school and sang the entire lyrics of Star Trek by the Firm.
Wow.
In front of my class, which was...
Did you have a lot of friends at school?
Not after that.
No.
Weirdly enough, I ploughed a lone furrow.
Did you
do
falsetto
years.
For parts of it?
I think I did.
Wow.
I think I did.
That's quite impressive.
Yeah.
Probably had a falsetto for all
yes,
of it.
Yes.
I wasn't like...
But Klingons, you say. Klingons.
Yes, Klingons. What did you think of these? Because we actually... They were hinted at in the first film. And,
yes, and
you know.
If anyone's got the DVD of the first one, you can see the Klingons, or rather you can see the Klingons in their masks in the deleted scene. So you see... their armour, their masks. Weirdly, I don't know if anyone see the DVD. It's quite interesting. They shot it using little children. Did anyone see that featurette? It's like a corridor. They didn't build a full size corridor. They built a miniature corridor and had little children dressed up as Klingon walking down it.
Yeah.
That's
which is quite cool.
Kind of weird.
There you go.
All right.
Check it out on the DVD.
This one,
these are full grown adult Klingons. But yeah, in the first one, as I was saying, they have the helmets, which have those sort of very distinctive forehead ridges on them.
They almost look a bit predatory, don't they?
A little bit, yeah. And in this one, you finally see them take those off. And beneath the helmet are the Klingons we know and love with a slight tweak. I think, were you to reimagine the Klingon for a modern audience, I don't think I could have done a better job.
No, and what I heard when I kind of visited the Bad Robot headquarters, they were talking about having... Yes, I know. I'm sorry, did I just drop that name? My goodness. When I was there, they were talking about how they'd kind of experimented with the Klingons, because kind of anything was open, because, of course, in the original series on TV, we saw the Klingons looking a bit like, you know, Ming the Merciless,
yes,
essentially.
Indeed.
And then, of course, we're familiar with the pasty-headed Worf and the likes of The Next Generation and the subsequent films. So they had kind of everything between that to play with, and they went through a lot of iterations and went really crazy and went really... really stripped back, and then ended up somewhere in the middle, quite close to what we now think of as Klingon standard.
See, when I spent an entire day at Bad Robot and a full hour speaking to JJ, we didn't speak about Klingons at all. But if we had, we would probably have talked about the fact that it's almost like Klingons go full punk, isn't it? Because I mean they've got piercings and their head ridges and gold sort of accents on it. I mean it's really quite cool. I mean I've always been a big fan of the Klingon aesthetic, and I know you mentioned the original series where they do, as you say, have slightly drooping moustaches, and they are not in any way alien looking at all. And there's that fantastic episode of Deep Space Nine, I believe Trials and Tribulations, where Worf sees the old Klingon and someone turns to him and thinks, I think it's Chief O'Brien, and so in a kind of quizzical, what's up with that? And he's like, we do not talk about it with outsiders. And then they pick it up in Enterprise. And the whole point is, I think they have to cure, I can't even remember this, I've blocked most of Enterprise out of my memory for good reason, but they have to cure some kind of disease, and I think they have to introduce human DNA. And their argument is that for, I think it's something like 10 generations, Klingons would lose the head ridges before their DNA started to reassert itself or something. And that's how they explain that in the original series, they have no head ridges.
Hmm,
so there you go.
10 generations.
Yeah, that's retconning its most destructive.
It really is.
But getting back to it, yes, the punk Klingons were awesome. All bald as well, seemed to be.
Looked like.
We don't see, well,
because they're known for their flowing locks, certainly in the Next Generation. So.
Yeah, that was interesting. And what do we think of their behaviour? They seem very Klingon.
They were very Klingon-y. I liked the fact that their ship was clearly a Klingon bird of prey, but looking a bit more rugged.
Yeah,
I liked that their guns were clearly the Klingon disruptors, but slightly more sort of streamlined. The only thing that didn't sit quite right with me is that Khan made such short work of a Klingon platoon, whereas, you know, they're such a Klingon hardcore.
That set him up as an ultimate badass.
There's ultimate badass, and there's ultimate badass. But still, yes.
So this was triple ultimate.
Yes.
And he did have, like, that big gun. And
he did. He did have a whopping minigun, yes. So I suppose you give him some credit for that. But, Klingon's good. I would honestly like to have seen more Klingons, and there's a part of me that hopes the next Star Trek really features the Klingons. To have the warlike alien race who's obsessed with honour is hardly original, but I really like the whole Klingon culture. I like the Empire. They were always my favourite Next Generation episodes, the ones where you went to the Klingon homeworld or the Klingons got involved. And
do you have a Batleth of your own?
I don't, though I do recall once coming into work and picking up a copy of the Metro, and they were talking on about how they'd had one of these, you know, they have these amnesty days where you can bring in your weapons and they'll just take them off you and melt them down and they won't arrest you for it. And as to show the sort of the state of society, the Metro taking a picture of a policeman holding a deadly 6-foot weapon and he's holding a Batleth and he's like, someone dropped off this, it's probably used for beheadings. Well, no, it's probably used for Klingon ritual combat, but anyway, I thought that was quite funny.
But yeah, hopefully, I mean, we talked about it already earlier, but a big Klingon Federation face off would be, or all out war would be great.
It would actually I think that would be a lot of fun,
and it would make a certain amount, as I said, a certain amount of sense given the current state of Starfleet in this other you know, universe, ultiverse, if you will.
Am I right in thinking, because I can't remember the motion picture very much, but there are no Klingons in Wrath of Khan, so they...
No, they Search for Spock is where they come in.
They appear for the first time in Search for Spock, whereas
Christopher Lloyd.
As Krug, is that right, Krug?
I cannot remember his name.
Which is really... I really like him in that movie.
He's not as good as Christopher Plummer's General Kang.
Oh, he's good.
In Star Trek VI.
He's very good.
Quoting Shakespeare good.
They are the classic.
Well, there's
if you notice him, he's a Hare Krishna Klingon. Have you noticed he's got the little tuft at the back of his head, which is unusual, really,
classic
for Klingons.
Trek bad guys. There's a lot. I think there's a lot to love about this film. I really like the fact that Scotty gets a lot to do. Cumberbatch aside, there's another newcomer, a couple of newcomers to the Star Trek universe with this one. Not character wise, because we've seen this character before, but Alice Eve as Carol Marcus.
She
goes on the ship as, was Carol Neville, something like that?
Or Carol Wallace.
Carol Wallace, thank you. And what do we make of this character?
I thought, for a start, calling her Carol Wallace was a bit of a mistake, because she's already been introduced, you know, across the world as Carol Marcus. So we had no, there was no suspense there, because we knew that was coming, which I thought was a bit of a shame. But I really liked her as a character, actually. She had some sort of good banter with Kirk and kind of everybody as well. I mean, she did have some feist to her, if you will.
Not the Canadian singer-songwriter.
Not the Canadian singer-songwriter, nor the fantasy novelist. but she was, you know, she was kind of sparkier than I was expecting, because I was kind of expecting a slightly disposable love interest, because quite frankly, in Wrath of Khan, Carol Marcus doesn't get a huge amount to do, despite being this genius scientist. You know,
I guess in Wrath of Khan, she's kind of done the most important thing, which is to produce a son for Kirk, who is in And so when is he bumped off in the next movie?
Yeah.
She's done the most important thing, some would say, in creating the Genesis device also.
And the Genesis device. Were you disappointed? I mean, there's lots of Wrath of Khan shout-outs in this movie. Were you disappointed that Genesis or any prog rock band from the 1970s wasn't involved in some way?
I think it's maybe a little bit too early for that. But at least they established her as a scientist. At least they established her as someone who's, you know, quite brave and inquisitive in terms of coming aboard to see what the heck is up with
often in a state of undress.
Occasionally in a state of undress, yes.
I think this is a better role for Alice Eve in a big science fiction-y blockbuster than last year's Men in Black 3, where she played... what was it? She played Emma Thompson's character?
Young O.
Yeah, and she has about four lines and she appears and
my feelings about that film are quite well documented. So
indeed, I think everyone's feelings about the film are.
I think she's kind of been on the verge for a while now. You know, she was supporting role in Sex and the City 2, stuff like that.
I must have missed that.
You didn't miss much, but she's kind of been on the verge. This might actually give her a bit more kind of a push. Yeah. I think,
and she's clearly going to be hanging around as.
She's now part of the crew, isn't she?
As Kirk says to her at the end with a flirtatious look in his eyes, welcome to the family. And she goes, "Oh, it's good to have a family," which I always thought, was a little bit insensitive. I mean, she just watched her dad have his head crushed, and he turned on the Federation. It's good to have a family. Well, yeah, I guess considering who your previous family was, I suppose,
and also considering her son got killed in the other timeline, so it's not her family is not a great family.
Yeah, it doesn't pay to be a Marcus, but obviously and I'm intrigued that the movie didn't go down this route. She and Kirk will bump uglies, I'm guessing, at some point.
It seems possible. Now, I wouldn't bet on it because part of the Star Trek thing is that Kirk has a thing for nailing anything with. Yes, anything female, human, vegetable, or mineral. That's part of the charm of Kirk. So, who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows indeed? But interesting, though, where this film leaves the state of the Federation, because the Dreadnought basically destroys San Francisco, essentially. So presumably hundreds of thousands, if not more, lives lost.
Lots of people in London. Not that many people in London.
London blown up, they crashed an enormous starship.
Yeah.
Alcatraz ruined, which presumably doesn't bode well for J.J. Abrams' TV show in that timeline either. So that's a shame.
Do you think that was his definitive...
Yeah, that's it. We're putting this to rest. Yeah, possibly.
Oh, man. I thought that sequence at the end was very good. The whole the destruction of San Francisco.
Gorgeously done. But San Francisco gets it really tough in movies. L.A. always survives, it seems, apart from Day After Tomorrow. San Francisco's been attacked and destroyed so many times. Poor San Francisco.
Well, apart from maybe the Hollywood sign, it has more...
More landmarks and if you're going to attack somewhere on the West Coast, you probably attack the Golden Gate Bridge, I guess.
Precisely. And of course, talking about cities getting it, London is getting it big time at the moment.
Yeah, this summer is not a good summer to be a Londoner.
Leave London alone, Hollywood. Jesus.
Yeah. Whatever, G.I. Joe.
Yeah, we got utterly destroyed in G.I. Joe. We got partially destroyed in Star Trek Into Darkness. Yeah. Thor 2 looks like it's going to...
Yeah, that's not going to be a good day for Greenwich.
F some S up, as they say, on PG-13 rated podcasts. So let's bring this thing to a crashing halt then. Let's come out of warp speed. Is that the right word, James?
You drop out of warp.
Drop out of warp. Let's drop out of warp and focus on our favourite aspects of the movie. Jimbo, what was your favourite moment overall from... JJ, your good close personal friend, JJ.
My good close personal friend. Him. I think the Klingons, the unmasking of the Klingons is one of them. The sequence on board the Dreadnought where Khan goes full Bruce Lee on some of the hired mercenaries is also a lot of fun. I like that too. Hard to pick, to be honest. I also really like when the Dreadnought opens fire on the Enterprise and drags it out of warp. I think that's a great sequence as well. It's nice to have a decent space battle in there. So hard for me to pick any particular one, but I mean, I enjoyed this to bits all the way through. So those are just three highlights for me.
Yeah. We probably all have some issues with the ending of the movie and the shout-outs to Wrath of Khan. I think maybe if it had just gone one more movie, it could have earned those a little bit more than it does. And my feelings on the Kirk death have been well documented. But I had a blast with this. For I'd say 95% of the movie, I had an absolute blast with the film. I really, really liked the space jump. I liked the fact that Khan and Kirk were teaming up, and that was an unexpected wrinkle for me, which I enjoyed. I liked more screen time for Scotty. I liked that whole space jump sequence leading into Scotty's confrontation with the big burly security guard on board that ship, which was quite funny. I think Carl Urban, please, because he's fantastic.
Just in general,
in this pod booth in life, it'd be great.
I you've blooming said all the ones I was going to say. The Space Aha. Jump, the Klingons.
You can have Alice Eve in the Shuttlecraft if you like.
What about the opening?
The opening with the Spock and the volcano.
It was actually very good.
The Raiders opening, that's very good.
Yeah, it was actually very good. I'm spoiled. I actually saw that in December, so I feel like I did.
We didn't see the best part of it, which was them drawing the picture in the sand, did we? I thought that was a fantastic comedy, that was just genius. And the way the shot then sort of fades into the sort of planned view shot of the Enterprise, that's great.
That was a really good one. I actually also, because I am clearly psychopathic, quite enjoyed the crash in San Francisco because it was just spectacular looking as a piece of cinema. It looked fantastic. Obviously, as a piece of loss of fictional human life, that was very disturbing.
Sulu's speech was incredible.
Yeah. Well done very to good. All. Because we all have the feeling that Sulu is a bit of a badass and he doesn't get to show it enough because Kirk's busy showing what a badass he is. And it was really good to see him get his moment. So all in all, there was a lot to love about it. There was a lot of kind of fun little beats in there, and it kind of bodes well for whatever this JJ guy does next.
Whatever he does.
Whatever that could be.
A small earthbound indie drama, no doubt. On that photon torpedo bombshell, then, I think it's a good time to bring our Star Trek Into Darkness spoiler podcast to an end. Don't forget the second spoiler podcast with Bob Orsi, Alex Kurtzman, Damon Lindelof, and Brian Burke will be up on or around May 24th, once everyone's had a chance. You guys have seen the film, obviously. Otherwise, you wouldn't be listening to this, otherwise you'd be just weird. But that'll be up on the 24th. If you want to hear the filmmakers explain the logic behind a lot of their decisions, then check that one out. It's going to be very, very essential. Until then, it's farewell from Helen.
Goodbye.
It's farewell from James.
Goodbye.
It's farewell from Ali.
Goodbye. It's not what it sounds like.
It's farewell from me. Thanks for listening. Bye.